From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, the latest episode of Bubber Talk delves into the history of two Milwaukee neighborhoods. We'll learn how to care for birds this winter in a new episode of Chirp Chat.
Keeping those feeders out doesn't keep the birds there longer. It just helps support them. So if they do choose to be there longer, or if they decided that they don't want to migrate, they'll still have those resources and that energy to keep going through the winter.
Plus, we'll learn about efforts to simplify the re-entry process from prison.
95% of the people that are in prison one day get out. If these individuals are releasing, and they are, how can we ensure, how can we maximize them becoming who you want them to become?
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. When you're driving around Wisconsin, you may start to notice a new type of highway interchange. A new roadway design called the Diverging Diamond is coming to southeastern Wisconsin on Saturday. It's already been tested in other parts of the state. The State Transportation Department constructed the new type of diamond where Brown Deer Road crosses I-43 in northern Milwaukee County. The old cloverleaf-style interchange there that involves circling on-ramps is gone. For a better look at the change, WUWM's Chuck Kornbach spoke with DOT project manager Steve Hoff near the park and ride lot at the southwest corner of 43 and Brown Deer. Hoff starts by describing the new road design.
The Diverging Diamond is a type of interchange that improves both safety and traffic flow by making it easier to turn left. And so we call them DDIs. So with the DDI, traffic as it approaches actually shifts onto the other side of the road briefly in order to make a smooth, free-flow left-hand turn onto the freeway.
So we're looking east on Brown Deer Road, and if people want to make a left turn onto I-43, what will they do differently?
So as they approach the interstate, they'll come up to a signalized intersection. That'll direct them across onto the opposite side of the roadway, onto the in this case, the north side of the road. They would then proceed straight, and then at the on-ramp onto the freeway to go north will then be on their left-hand side, and so that's a free-flow move onto the freeway. They don't have to cross oncoming traffic like you would at a typical intersection where you might have a green arrow to do that. This is just a free-flow move directly onto the freeway, so that saves time by not needing a separate arrow to turn, and it's just an efficient way to move traffic through.
Presumably, the westbound traffic will make the opposite flip, is that right?
That is correct, yep. And those signals are staggered such that it'll allow traffic to move through both signals, and then with the other opposite side stopped, and then once that traffic gets through, then the opposite side would go through both those intersections as well.
The state, of course, has been rebuilding I-43 in this part of Milwaukee County. Why is this a good site here at Brown Deer Road and 43? Why is it a good option to have the Diverging Diamond?
So Diverging Diamond interchanges work really well when we've got a heavy left turn movement like we do in this location, especially as an example, westbound to southbound, a lot of folks heading south to go into Milwaukee. And so with that efficiency I mentioned, with that direct left turn onto the freeway, it handles a lot more traffic that way at an interchange like this versus needing to wait for that left turn arrow. And in terms of volumes during our peak hour, we have roughly 1,100 vehicles per hour that are making that move to head south. We also have 800 vehicles per hour that are going north, so it's still a substantial number of cars. But just for comparison, we have about 300 vehicles an hour that are going straight through. So you can see just the ratios, there are a lot more vehicles turning to go either direction compared to going straight through. And so that's where these Diverging Diamonds really work well with that heavy, heavy turn movements like we have in this area.
There are a few of these Diverging Diamonds around the state, near Janesville, near Appleton. How would you rate their success so far?
So far, they've done very well. As an example, the one in Appleton is at Highway 441 and Oneida Street, and that's been open about 5 years, and they were able to check the crash data before the DDI and after, and they actually found there was about a 40% reduction in crashes after the DDI was constructed.
To what do you attribute that reduction?
So the nice thing about the DDI is it reduces the number of conflict points at an interchange or at an intersection. just to get a little technical, but in terms of numbers, you know, there's 26 different points at a typical intersection where you could run into somebody. And as an example, if you're going straight and somebody's turning left, they could turn left in front of you. That would be one conflict point. And so with a typical intersection, there's 26 of those. Because we're removing those left turns, taking those out of the equation, you're now down to 14. And so you've got 14 conflict points. And so fewer opportunities where someone could run into somebody else makes it generally a safer interchange or safer intersection.
Are these diverging diamond interchanges more expensive, less expensive? We're talking short-term, long-term?
The diverging diamonds are actually slightly less expensive than a typical interchange, and that has to do with when I was talking about the left turn lanes, how in this case, with that heavy left turn to go south, we actually would need two separate left turn lanes, and then we would also need another lane to go north, so three extra lanes just to handle those left turns. Because with the diverging diamond, we don't have those separate moves, we don't have to build that extra infrastructure. So that's 36 feet of extra roadway that we're not building here. So it's a smaller footprint overall than that typical interchange. So that translates to less cost, because in this case, it's over the freeway, so that's bridge cost. And so it's about a $250,000 savings by building the diverging diamond compared to a standard diamond interchange.
How pedestrian friendly will it be?
These work really well for both pedestrians and for bicyclists. And certainly we've got a real heavy pedestrian use through here with the park and ride lot, and then the freeway, and then all the shopping opportunities on the other side of the freeway. And so we've got new sidewalk that's being constructed here as part of the project. That'll then connect to the center island, and the sidewalk itself will be in the middle of the diverging diamond. There'll be a path that's in the middle of the diverging diamond over the freeway. And that'll be separated from traffic with two barrier walls, concrete barrier walls on both sides of it. And so both pedestrians and bikes can then use that centerpiece to go over the freeway, and then they'll cross at that second signalized intersection to get back to the regular sidewalk and then continue, you know, into the shopping areas or back here to the parking lot.
There's school nearby too.
And there, yes, certainly, and there's the school directly behind the park and ride as well.
Many things can happen in federal and state transportation policies. The Wisconsin DOT viewed this diverging diamond as something that will become more frequent, or is it a case by case? How would you describe the future?
It's certainly a case by case basis. We want to put the best fit at each location depending on traffic volumes and where folks are going, you know, turning movements and things like that. But will you see more of these in the future? Yeah, definitely. There are several that are planned for different areas around the state. Including in this region. You know, as of right now, this is the first one in the Southeast region, but there are more that are currently in the design phase, and they'll be coming in future years.
Besides this outreach you're doing right now, what else is the DOT doing to inform people? Is there going to be more signage at this interchange, advertisements? How do you get out the word to people that might not see every newscast?
We've been talking about this one in this location for over 10 years. You know, we've been working on the design of this project for quite a while. And at each of the public meetings that we have, we always show the diverging diamond as the option here for Brown Deer Road. And by and large, it was well received. You know, folks are curious. It's something new. It's something different. But well received, and folks have been willing to give it a chance, as something that should work well. We have our website. The DOT website, and specifically this project, is on there. We have videos on the website that show how to drive it. There's renderings of what it would look like from a driver's perspective to drive through it as you approach the signalized intersection, where you're going to be directed and that type of thing. So those materials are out there as well on the website.
And signage on the roadway, are there more signs, bigger signs, flashing signs? How would you describe what you... people that might not be familiar with this interchange, visitors to town, warnings they'll encounter as they approach?
The signing and the pavement marking working together really make it clear where you're to go. And the way that the lanes are set up, the way that the lanes bring you into the signalized intersection, you know, it's clear you're going at that point. Once you cross over, you're going straight ahead, and then following, you know, the lane markings as well as the signing. We'll have overhead signs that will direct you depending if you're going north or south on the freeway or straight through on Brown Deer Road. All that signing will be set up ready for the driver.
Finally, these diverging diamonds are popping up in an era where a lot of people are driving too fast. What is your confidence level about trying something new in this era where people should slow down?
And that's great advice, you know, for all drivers, is to approach things cautiously and slow down. And the diverging diamond with the signalized intersection is set up such that as you come toward the signal, it's on a bit of a curve, and so it's naturally going to slow the driver down. If there's a red light, you know, that of course they're going to stop there. And so as they go between the two signalized intersections, that's a shorter distance, but they're going to be driving at a slower rate of speed, just having slowed down to the first signal, then going through a curve, and then going to the second signal. So I think it'll naturally help to slow traffic down a bit as they approach the freeway. When you don't have to wait as long, your patience isn't being tested and things like that, and so you're getting through quicker, and before you know it, you've driven through it, and you might, first time you think, oh, that was a little bit different, but after that, you know, it's just as if you've been doing them for a number of years.
What monitoring will you be doing in terms of safety or accidents or other problems? What sort of monitoring in the months ahead?
Longer term, we'll be monitoring this in terms of, we always come back and check crashes and see how it's been going, and if there is any certain issues that have to be addressed, then certainly we would do that in the future. And you know, that's something we did, as I mentioned previously, up in Appleton with the Highway 441 on Ida Street. We did check crashes over a 5-year period and then compared it to where it was before, and found that it's worked really well. You know, crashes were reduced by that 40% I mentioned, and so definitely a very positive result, and we would certainly hope for that at this location as well.
Steve Hoff is a project manager for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Kornbach, and for more information about the Wisconsin DOT plan, you can go to the agency's website and search Brown Deer Road Diverging Diamond Interchange. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. Later this hour, you'll hear the newest episode in our Bubbler Talk series, which answers listener questions about the Milwaukee area. But first, we learn about the birds that stay in Wisconsin during the winter and how we can help them survive. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most people can easily survive the winter weather by layering up and turning on the heater. But it's a bit more complicated for birds. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with regional conservation specialist Toby Siegert at the Milwaukee County Zoo. He says winter is a great time to keep the backyard bird feeder stocked so you can help birds stay nourished throughout the season. He also discusses how the county zoo takes care of wild birds year-round.
I am so excited to be chatting with you today at the Milwaukee County Zoo. And you know, Toby, some people might not know this, but the zoo doesn't just care for its own animals. It also cares for wild birds. Can you tell me about the Wild Birds Program?
Yeah, for sure. The Society supports the Wild Birds Program. We do weekly point count surveys, so I'll go out with a bunch of volunteers and we go birding every Tuesday morning. We also do, in the wintertime, we'll do Project Feeder Watch. So we've got a bunch of different bird feeder stations throughout the zoo. So next time you're visiting the zoo, take a peek, see if you can find the feeders located around the walkways. But we're in charge of filling all of those feeders, and that helps support the birds in the winter months especially because they have trouble finding food that time of year. We also support a MODIS program, so we've got a MODIS tower on zoo grounds, which is pretty cool. It's this newer technology, so newer than bird banding, but they attach these little like chips to the back of a bird, and it allows us to track their migration, which is pretty cool.
Whoa, lots of different things.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Do you get to do that, the MODIS?
So I'm working towards hopefully getting to do that in the future, but right now we'll send staff down to Belize and they help deploy MODIS trackers down there with the hopes that those birds are then migrating back up to Wisconsin.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So something that you'd mentioned, you said one way that the zoo cares for wild birds is by putting out plenty of feeders, but I was interested, with winter coming up, do you put feeders away? It seems like we don't.
No, so I actually keep the feeders out year-round, and you'll see that there will be a lot of different species that will come to the feeders. You'll notice that robins have been sticking around. Historically, you know, robins will migrate because it's all about food resources. But as, you know, climate change is impacted and food availability is still available for robins to eat, they'll stay around year-round. So you might actually see robins in the winter now. Same thing with, like, Canada geese. Those stick around year-round quite often. So keeping up those feeders does provide a lot of food for those birds. And they kind of become reliant almost on those feeders, too.
Right. I was going to ask you, like, why is it important to, like, have these feeders out, especially in the wintertime?
Yeah. So keeping them out, it provides that food resource. They eat a lot of seeds and rely on a lot of the plants that are blooming during the spring and the summer. And in the fall and the winter, a lot of those plants are done blooming, and there's not as much seed availability. And so they're out competing each other for what limited resources are available. And so providing those extra resources, you know, extra food actually really does help support those birds. So,
and I feel like one, like, myth, I guess you could call it, is if you do keep your bird feeders out, you're not making birds not migrate.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. So if a bird wants to migrate, it'll migrate. its body will tell it that it's time to move on. Keeping those feeders out doesn't keep the birds there longer. It just helps support them. So if they do choose to be there longer, or if they decided that they don't want to migrate, they'll still have those resources and that energy to keep going through the winter.
Right. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
And so what type of bird feeders and feed do you recommend people keep out?
So in the winter, I recommend suet always, just because it is a higher fat content, and a lot of birds really are looking for that higher fat content. I'll also put out in the winter black oil sunflower seed. It's what we put out here at the zoo as well. And then a lot of finch species really like the Niger seed. So we'll also be putting that out year round as well for them. And those all tend to have a higher fat content, which the birds really like. So.
Right. And another resource is, should we keep water out for birds throughout the winter?
Yeah. So that's another really, really valuable resource, especially in the cold weather, because there's not as much open water. And so keeping a heated bird bath is really, really helpful, especially in the winter as a lot of stuff starts to freeze, as temperatures start to drop. So you can also, like, if you have a metal bird bath or a plastic bird bath, they actually do even sell, like, heated bird bath inserts that you can put into an existing bird bath if you don't want to go out and buy, like, a new one. But they do also just sell heated bird baths. But yeah, providing water is really, really important too.
So what are the types of birds that tend to stick around for the wintertime?
We get a lot of cardinals. A lot of people love seeing cardinals. We also have a lot of chickadees. We'll get a lot of different finches. So we have goldfinches. Those tend to stick around year-round. They don't look as pretty and bright yellow. This time of year, they're more drab and olive-colored. But they do stick around year-round. So if you're seeing birds and you're like, I don't know what that is, it might be a goldfinch, that you're just not aware that it's a goldfinch. It looks a little different. We also get house finches this time of year, house sparrows, robins. They tend to stick around occasionally. You'll also see a lot of woodpeckers this time of year. So red-bellied woodpeckers, downy woodpeckers, hairy woodpeckers, they're all feeder favorites. So I tend to see them quite often at our suet feeders. They absolutely go bananas for suet. that's oftentimes what we'll see.
And why is it that the goldfinch might look a little drabbier, like a little brown bird?
Yeah, so goldfinches get what's called alternate plumage. So in the springtime, the males will molt and they get that really nice vibrant yellow and nice vibrant black cap, and that's to attract the ladies, be more attractive. And then when they're done with the breeding season, they'll get a little bit more drab. They molt again to become more drab so that they are less detectable by predators, because the duller olive color blends in really well with, like, all that dead vegetation this time of year, and that helps prevent them from getting predated on.
Wow, that's amazing. So where are some good type of places to place your feeder, like closer to trees, or, like, yeah, what kind of habitat or environment?
That's a very good question. So if you're putting them in your backyard or near any kind of building with a window, we tend to recommend that people have their feeder either less than 3 feet away from the window or greater than 10 feet away from the window. And that's just so that when birds are flying, if they happen to be flying the direction of your window, if it's less than 3 feet, they're not able to get enough momentum to hit and injure themselves. And if it's greater than 10 feet, they're less likely to smack into the window. But other than that, I mean, you can put them up just about anywhere. People will even spread like suet. They sell suet that you can spread onto trees and that kind of stuff. And woodpeckers will go crazy for it. You might attract some squirrels too, but they like it, so.
Nice. So what are some things people should keep in mind when keeping their feeders out to keep birds safe?
Yeah, I recommend this with any bird feeder. You want to regularly clean them out. And that's just something that you should regularly be doing anywho, because it's good for the bird's health. And it also helps decrease disease transmission. So different kinds of diseases will pass among birds if they're, you know, feeding at the same feeder, that kind of stuff. So going through and cleaning stuff out, removing food if it's moldy, that usually is a bigger problem in the summer when it gets like really wet and humid. And typically in the winter it tends to be drier, but it really does depend. But making sure that you're filling them and cleaning it out regularly.
And you mentioned that another way the zoo cares for wild birds is by doing weekly count surveys. What are you monitoring for when you're doing those?
Yeah, so we're kind of checking biodiversity. We go to 11 different stations throughout the zoo, and we stop for 5 minutes. I'll set a timer, and we basically sit there and look and listen for birds. And I'll record every single species that we've either seen or heard. Also, we'll run Merlin, which is a free app. If you don't already have it, I recommend it. It's a lot of fun. And we'll run it on all of our phones just in case there's something that we didn't hear. And I denote in my notes whether we saw, heard, or if Merlin picked up the species. And all that information gets put into a database that I maintain. And then we also upload all of it to eBird so that it can be used by scientists and researchers to kind of study bird populations as well.
Nice. And how have you noticed the winter weather affect your weekly bird counts in any way?
Yeah, so that's kind of the cool part. We've been doing this for a little over 2 years now. So we've got some comparable, you know, trends that we can see from year to year, which is pretty cool. We're able to notice, you know, seasonality wise, like we've been getting, you get different species during, you know, depending on what time of year it is. We also have noticed, like, depending on if they're doing any kind of maintenance, that impacts, like, what species we're seeing in certain areas, that kind of stuff, which is really cool. And it's helpful for us because then we can inform ground staff, hey, this is what we're seeing, like, this is how it's impacting, like, you know, the biodiversity of the area, that kind of stuff. And so we can kind of open up a conversation and kind of have that dialogue about conservation impacts, too.
I know the Milwaukee County Zoo also opened a backyard bird walk exhibit last year. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So it's a pretty cool exhibit. I recommend next time you're visiting the zoo to come and take a peek at it. It's really nice in the summer. It's got a bunch of picnic tables, benches, that kind of stuff. But essentially what it is it's an area to learn about bird conservation. So we've got a bunch of different sections of the bird walk. So the first section, you've got a bunch of different types of nest boxes, things that you can actually even put up in your own yard if you would like to. We've got an entire section dedicated to bird feeders. So it's got just about every single kind of bird feeder that you could possibly imagine in that section and explaining what species are attracted to what kind of feeder. We've also got a section dedicated to bird strikes. So it's a giant window display that shows all these different options of things that you can put on your windows at home to help prevent bird strikes because they are a significant killer of birds, unfortunately. But it's a really cool just way to learn about conservation and how you can help conserve stuff in your backyard. And we've got a ton of native plants planted back there, too. So it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful in the summer. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to visit. I'm listening to you talk, and I know we just kind of touched on this. But for some people who are listening, how does this wild birds program go hand in hand with what the zoo's doing?
Yeah, so it all contributes to conservation work, right? So honestly, what we're doing is we're studying the property, what we're doing here in our own home. Because even though we participate in all of this global conservation work, because we have a lot of, you know, global species here as part of our collection, it's also really important to conserve what we have here. And our zoo is one of the few zoos that really doesn't have a whole lot of developed areas. We've got a lot of wooded areas on the zoo property, which is really, really cool. It's something that people really love about our zoo. It's one of the biggest features that people say that they enjoy. And so we kind of have something special here and kind of taking a look at what we have and how we can help support the species that are calling this place home. Because even though we've got, you know, the animals in our collection, it's important to take care of what we have here too.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month.
Sure.
I am so sorry to put you on the spot. I know it's really hard, but what's a bird you'd like to highlight this month?
I'm a woodpecker guy. I really like red-bellied woodpeckers.
Yeah, talk about them.
Yeah, yeah. So they really don't have a lot of red on their belly, but there's already a red-headed woodpecker, so they can't call them red-headed woodpeckers. But they have a nice red patch on the back of their head. They've got the nice gradient black and white speckling on their backside. And they're just really funny. They're charismatic. I oftentimes will find them, you know, hopping around the tree, squawking at me. Sometimes when I'm filling feeders, there'll be one sitting in the tree, like, squawking at me because he knows I'm filling the feeder and he wants to get in first dibs. they're just very charismatic. Woodpeckers are just a lot of fun, I find. They make some really interesting calls, too. So
yeah, does a red belly make an interesting call in any way?
Yeah, I feel like almost every woodpecker species sounds like it's laughing. Like, that's what I always feel like their calls sound like, at least, like, the longer versions of their calls. It kind of just sounds like they're having a chuckle. Downy, hairy, red-bellied, northern flicker, they all have a little bit of a different laugh, just like people. So I think that that's a lot of fun to watch out for, too.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks for sharing that with me. Mm-hmm. Well, Toby, I really appreciate you for speaking with me today and helping me learn how to take care of birds this winter.
Yeah, for sure. Happy to help.
Toby Siegert is the Regional Conservation Specialist for the Zoological Society of Milwaukee. He spoke with LegFX expert Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, but we still need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Did you know the neighborhood of National Park used to be home to an amusement park? Bubbler Talk has that story coming up in about 20 minutes. But first, we hear from a formerly incarcerated man who now works to help others transition from prison to the outside world. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Leg Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. After being convicted of murder in the 1990s at the age of 15, Adam Procell was sentenced to life in prison. He was paroled in 2018 and has since spent his life addressing issues with the reentry system. This started by working directly with formerly incarcerated people to help them navigate the system. Procell has since branched into centralizing reentry services to make it easier to navigate for people reentering society, as well as working to build trust between formerly incarcerated people and police. Procell joined Lake Effect's Sam Woods to talk about his work, starting with how he felt reentering society after prison.
When I began my journey inside, and I say this kind of laughing, but I had a pager. Mm-hmm. People obviously really don't use pagers anymore unless you're an ER doctor.
A while ago, yeah.
And there was no internet as we know it. I lived with my mom. She did my laundry because I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I essentially just had to understand what does it mean to be an adult, a law-abiding adult in a society. And thankfully, and I give a lot of credit to somebody that a lot of people in my space wouldn't want to credit, but my supervision agent gave me just time to breathe. She didn't force me into getting a job the week that I got out. She didn't force me into a lot of different things. She said, you don't even understand what it feels like to be free as an adult, so just take some time. Thankfully, I was blessed with a family that created a soft landing spot when I returned home. And so I didn't have to search for a home. I had residence. I didn't have to search for transportation. I was allowed to use the family car. And so that I was just given an opportunity to breathe and understand, like, what does it feel like to be an adult? And I know that sounds odd to say.
No, yeah.
But the first, I would say, day, unusual way to describe this, but it was terrible. As crazy as that sounds, because being released from prison should be, and was, one of the most joyous occasions of my life. But the pressure within that first 24 hours, it was almost painful. And I remember sitting at the kitchen table in my grandmother's house and feeling to myself that this is terrible, because the pressure in my chest from just the amount of emotion that I was feeling, it made it uncomfortable. Again, not to say that it was a bad thing, but it just at that moment was like, this is terrible. I feel so uncomfortable right now because I'm being flooded with emotion. The second day, it got much better, and then following that, it got a lot better. But that first 24 hours, it was really a, I don't want to use the word negative to prelude the word experience, but it wasn't pleasant, as unusual as that sounds.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like a, you know, a shock to the system, and a shock to, you know, you at that point, you know, spent most of your life in prison and grown up from the age of, you know, from your teen years to this point. And so, yeah, I mean, I can understand the kind of, like, yes, I should be feeling, and it was, you know, joyous, but at the same time, like, well, okay, what now? Like, what right. do I do now? But in that time since 2018, in that initial shock, I think it's fair to say that you found you're finding your way. You wear a lot of hats. You teach at Marquette University. You work with Partners in Hope, Paradigm Shift, as well as Home to Stay. And so I know that's a lot of hats. And so I'm going to give you, I'll let you kind of describe how all those hats intersect and how they're informed by that past experience, particularly with the reentry process.
Yes, it's always difficult to sort of manage the hats, at least in explanation form. But via timeline, I would begin with Partners in Hope, because I was actually interviewed for that job in a prison visiting room in 2018, a month before I was released. My then CEO got permission from the warden to conduct a job interview in the prison visiting room, because, as I was told by him, they were forming a program called Partners in Hope, and it's a faith-based prisoner reintegration organization. And he said, I'm just some white guy from Indiana that has zero street cred. Nobody's going to hear anything I have to say. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for individuals that understand what change looks like and can help others transition successfully back into the community. And so that's sort of where my journey into the reentry space began, really actually before I even stepped foot into society. And when I got to Milwaukee, I started to realize that Milwaukee has a fair amount, almost an abundance of reentry resources. But the problem is they're all siloed and nobody speaks to one another. And we essentially have to rely on a supervision agent to, one, know of their existence, two, have the time, and three, have the hope that an individual that is being released has the ability to get to wherever this resource is, because they're all over the city. And so that kind of transitioned into one of the next steps, or next hats, if you will, of Home to Stay, where we decided, okay, how can we maximize effectiveness when it comes to connecting individuals that are reentering society with the resources that they need? So we thought, well, what if we brought 30, 40 reentry service providers into one location? And so once a month, usually the first Wednesday of every month from noon to 2 at 324 West North Avenue, we conduct Home to Stay Reentry Resource Fairs, where we do just that. We bring in roughly 35 to 40 reentry service providers, employers, and people that just want to help people succeed. And we get a lot of individuals that are on supervision that come at the behest of their agent. And a lot of times they'll meet their agent and conduct those weekly or monthly supervision meetings literally in the space where so many of their reentry resource needs can be met. So we are located on a bus line, because that's another issue that we found to be a huge barrier. A lot of individuals don't have transportation. And so if you have a resource that's completely on the other side of the town, that's nowhere near a bus line.
You're not getting to it.
You're not. I can be the best resource in the world, but nobody's going to be able to get to it. So we are on a major bus line, which people really don't think about that, but that's hugely important.
Mm-hmm. On this topic of having a one-stop shop for reentry services, I know a lot of people who have either worked in nonprofits or social services or have tried to navigate social service systems that this feeling of everything being siloed that you're talking about is going to be very familiar. But from your experience with reentry, what difference would it have made to have just kind of everything in one place as opposed to, I'm guessing, kind of having to go over to this side of town for this, for, you know, employment resources and this other side of town for housing resources and et cetera? What difference would it have made to have all of that just in one spot as you're trying to do here with Home to Stay?
I think the easiest way to understand this is, and this is no excuse, it's more of a reality check to the situation. If it is difficult to essentially change the way you live your life, people are going to fail. Mm-hmm. For a lot of those in society, it isn't a big deal to go get a Social Security card. It isn't a big deal to go get a bank account. It isn't a big deal to go sign up for healthcare. But if you've never done any of those things, and as soon as you get out, you have to go do all those things, you don't have a car, you don't know where any of them are at, it starts to feel overwhelming. And again, this is not an excuse. But we have to understand that, okay, if we don't change the way we think, if we don't meet people where they are, we're just going to keep ending up in the same cycle. And so if it is too difficult for somebody to completely rearrange their life, they go back to what's comfortable, what they know. And unfortunately, oftentimes, that's a criminal lifestyle. And so we have to find a way to make change attainable. And right now, it's not.
Yeah. I think there's some folks who hear that and say, well, I made it without all this help. I figured it out. And so, you know, as part of reentering society, you should be able to as well. You mentioned the necessity of having compassion and meeting someone where they're at when they're reentering society. But can you talk more about just like how not meeting people where they're at kind of sets people up for failure when it comes to reentering society?
Sure. A way I try to explain that is if someone asked you to solve this equation, some math equation, and you never had a math teacher that taught you these things, well, how would you solve that math problem? Mm-hmm. You just assume that everybody has been given these same resources as they grew up. So if you don't understand how to solve a particular math problem, what do you do at that point? You need to solve it.
Right.
And so if I'm at that point where I don't have the skills, I don't have the knowledge to solve that math problem, well, then I'm not going to try to solve it. I'm going to go do something else. Mm-hmm. So going back to successfully reacclimating to a non-criminal lifestyle, if that's the quote-unquote answer to the problem, I can't do it. I just don't have the skills or tools necessary, well, then I'm not going to be that. Mm-hmm. And so we need to find a way to understand it's not about minimizing. It's not about giving people a free pass. When people make mistakes, myself included, we do need to be held responsible. But we can't unring that bell. And so now we're at the point where 95% of the people that are in prison one day get out. That's just a fact.
Right.
If these individuals are releasing, and they are, how can we ensure, how can we maximize them becoming who you want them to become? Your neighbor, somebody that's going to stand next to you in the grocery line, whatever it is, we need to give them the tools. And so me just saying, do better, or yeah, don't do this, or I did it, you can too. Well, how's that working out for us? It's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have to take a different approach.
And then so in this effort that you have with, you know, Partners in Hope, Paradigm Shift, Home to Stay, all these entities, it seems like you're trying to build towards that different approach. But I'm guessing that there are barriers to that work, whether it be political or power struggle barriers or funding barriers. I'm sure it's not just, you know, you just say what you said to me right now and then it just like clicks for everyone, right?
So I wish it were that easy.
Yeah. So while doing this work and wearing all the hats that you do wear, what kind of barriers are you encountering when it comes to either changing minds or changing policy?
Yeah, that's one of the more grueling aspects of this work. But the work itself is already grueling.
Yeah.
And then it seems like we're fighting half of the people that want people to successfully reintegrate back into our society. Mm-hmm. A lot of people within the reentry space want to point the finger in the eye of the system and tell the system, you suck. And at the end of the day, I think people lose sight of the system isn't some boogeyman in the corner. The system is run by humans. And when a human gets a finger stuck in their eye, they really don't react positively. And so the system buckles. The system bristles, rather. And when the system bristles, I feel people in the reentry space, especially those with lived experience, don't necessarily have a voice. And so we take a completely different approach. We reach out to the system and say, we understand that you cannot do this by yourself. We can't do it by ourselves. So let's find a way to collaboratively work together. And one of those areas that we really lean into is with law enforcement. And I know a lot of individuals, especially those getting out of prison, really don't want to interact with police officers.
Yeah, understandably.
And yeah, I get that. Police officers are often looked at as the representation of authority. And if your mindset is authority doesn't like me, it's just a little bit easier to buck authority, i.e. commit crimes, go against it. So we bring in police officers and we have them lean in with love to those that are just getting out of prison and become mentors, believe it or not, to those that are getting out of prison. And when you have a police officer, i.e. the system, leaning into you with love and compassion and a hand saying, how can I help you succeed? You don't want to let that system, i.e. authority, down. By default, subconsciously, you're really not wanting to commit a crime without even realizing it, which is all fine and well, but a lot of people within this reentry space kind of look at me like, ah, you're working with the police. We don't like them, so therefore we don't necessarily like you because you're part of them.
Yeah. So you mentioned a lack of trust between from people who are reentering society from prison towards police officers, and how your role is often to kind of break down barriers and rebuild trust from the bottom up between these two parties. And I'm curious if you also have, like, what kind of work you have to do on the other side for law enforcement or other, you know, either law enforcement or just people in society generally who also don't really trust someone who's just coming from prison.
Absolutely. And sometimes I don't know which is harder,
yeah,
to help those getting out of prison understand that an officer is human, or to help an officer understand that somebody who has committed a very violent act, that they literally spend a career trying to get off of the streets, is now becoming potentially their neighbor. And again, back to us taking an approach of let's work with the system, I think that has allowed me access to, well, in fact, I know it has, where officers are trained at the police academy, and giving the opportunity to have sessions, giving the opportunity to humanize those like myself who had made mistakes, helping them understand that, yes, you put handcuffs on somebody, but if they are allowed back into our society, why that can essentially make your job easier, safer, if we look at each other as human. One of the most pivotal things that we do is traffic stop etiquette at Partners in Hope, where we reverse the roles. We have those that just got out of prison become the officers, and we have the police officers become the driver, so each can understand the mindset of the other, and we run them through various scenarios. And our guys and girls get shot every single time. And it's not that we're sadists or want our returning citizens to be shot, but we want them to understand what's going on in the mindset of an officer during one of these traffic stops. Conversely, we want officers to understand if somebody's on parole for a long time and they think they're going back to prison for the rest of their life because of the way an officer's acting, well, that might put that officer's life in danger. Again, no excuse. So we really want to help each understand the mindset of the other.
Yeah. Adam, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect and spending your time with me and telling us about all the work you're doing and all the trust that you're building out there.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate it.
Adam Procell is a reentry strategist working in various roles with Partners in Hope, Paradigm Shift, and Home to Stay. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods last year. A new season of Bubbler Talk just kicked off this month. It's WUWM's series where we answer your questions about the Milwaukee area. For this week's Bubbler Talk, we dig into the history of the Silver City and National Park neighborhoods.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM student digital producer Graham Thomas. Just south of the Menominee River Valley and west of the Mitchell Park Domes lie Milwaukee's National Park and Silver City neighborhoods. Ever since listener Brandon Peyton Carrillo moved to National Park from Bayview in 2020, he's been curious about the history of the area.
I got this old Milwaukee map from 1898, and I was trying to find, my house. And on the map there is like a green space. And I was like, oh, that's weird.
After some research, Brandon realized that his neighborhood was home to an amusement park in the late 19th century.
I want to know more about what this park was like.
I contacted Milwaukee historian John Gerda looking for answers. We'll get back to the park in a minute, but first, some background on the Silver City neighborhood.
That became a very German neighborhood in the later 1800s. And then, as the years went on, it became so industrial, it attracted a lot of industrial immigrants. And these workers developed, as you would expect, a powerful thirst.
With 24 saloons at one point in the 1800s, Gerda says Silver City was a
drinking man's, working man's paradise. And back in those days, early days of industrialization there, 1890s and so, you weren't paid by a direct deposit. You weren't paid by check. You were paid in silver coin. So these guys, whatever payday was, they'd get paid and they would belly up to the bar, and the counters would just be awash in silver. So I think the legend is somebody walked into one of the saloons and said, "This must be Silver City because of all the coins on the table." So that's where Silver City came from.
When factory workers and machinists from Harnischwager, the Falk plant, and the Milwaukee Road Shops weren't spending their silver at the saloon, the nearby amusement park offered respite. The story of the park starts in 1883, when two local promoters bought a 44-acre tract of land at what is now 27th and National. They named this rural wooded retreat National Park, after the nearby National Soldiers' Home. They put in a small pond, a two-story pavilion with a ballroom, and a racetrack for trotting horse, bicycle, and eventually motorcycle races.
You also had the Scottish Highland Games were out there. You'd have labor picnics.
National Park was big enough to host fox hunts in the woods, despite objections from the Milwaukee Humane Society. In 1885, the park's crown jewel was built, Milwaukee's very first roller coaster. Guests could pay a nickel for two rickety rides around the coaster's 500-foot latticework loop. One Milwaukee Sentinel reporter who gave it a spin said,
"The sensation produced by the first ride is goneness. When the car reaches the last dip in the track, it attains a fearful velocity, which sends it to the starting point again." So it was kind of adrenaline back in 1885.
Gerda says by the end of the century, however, the park's 16-year joyride had run its course.
So back in 1899, a couple of Eastside entrepreneurs bought the entire parcel and announced that they would plan to, as they put it, cut it up into building lots. So when you look at that area today, the houses are of a very uniform age. Well, they're all very early 1900s, so the turn of the 20th century.
Which brings us back to Bubbler Talk question asker Brandon Peyton Carrillo.
My house is one of the last houses that was built in the neighborhood. This house is 100 years old this year.
Today, Silver City is known for its diverse food scene and access to the Menominee Valley via Three Bridges Park, the Hank Aaron Trail, and the Urban Ecology Center. Brandon hopes to make Silver City a neighborhood that's also known for its music scene. He's a musician and the organizer of Antonio Fest, Milwaukee's first ever Latin alternative music festival. And he wrote this song about his neighborhood called Silver City.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Palermo's Pizza and Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
If you've missed last week's Bubbler Talk, which explored the question of whether Milwaukee is a community of haters, you can find that at WUWM.com/bubblertalk. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Chuck Kornbach and Susan Benz from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a preview of WUWM's upcoming special about Milwaukee radio personality and legend Bob Reitman. Plus, our Books and Beyond series will explore Milwaukee Public Library's Entrepreneurship in Residence program. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Es la ciudad de Plata.